Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. Well, I'm just going to begin by giving you a sense of the sort of the pattern of this morning, what we're going to be doing, and say a little bit about why we're here. And to some extent, at least, what we're doing here is continuing a conversation that Alan and I have been having for some years now, seems very many years, about the different things that we do and the overlaps between the materials, the places that we work on. Now, just to put it in context, I'm an archaeologist. Archaeologists deal with old things. And time was when most archaeologists dealt with objects with a fairly limited number of questions in mind. Where's it from? How old is it? What was it for? The function of things, often the most important. And of course, then there's also the question that we're asked more commonly than any other, how much is it worth? So there's been a sort of fairly sort of common thread through a lot of archaeological work on objects from the historic and the prehistoric past. But over the last 10, 20 years, archaeologists have started to sort of stretch themselves a little bit and started to ask very different kinds of questions of their material. Because things aren't just for a particular purpose. Things just aren't from a particular time. Objects, as we know from our kitchen drawers and our mantelpieces, have all sorts of funny connections with ourselves. Ideas that connect people through objects, people from our families from distant generations, or other members of families, other connections. And so there is a connection between objects and biographies, which is starting to snap into focus in a lot of archaeological writing. And essentially, what a lot of people are trying to experiment now is the idea that objects tell stories. Objects have histories, they have biographies. Sometimes they act on people and encourage them to remember certain things, places, people, ideas. Now, as archaeologists have started to stretch themselves, maybe get a little more imaginative in the way that they approach the things that they excavate, so they begin to realize that the language that they use, the forms of expression that they commonly use to try and explain, describe, or put across what's important about those objects, that language comes up short, that language is found wanting. Because I'm sure some of you at least may have read one or two archaeology books occasionally, long time ago, they were absolutely thrilling to read. But a lot of them are very, very boring. This thing is 10 centimeters long, it weighs half kilogram, whatever. But as we've started to look at different qualities to things, so we begin to realize that we need to write about them in different ways. And that's where the conversations that Alan and I have been having over the last few years have really started to explore overlaps. Because in Alan's work that I've certainly been reading since I was a child, you find just that sense of the connections between things and people, and things and places. So, I'm not going to turn into an academic. The way the pattern of today is going to run is that we're going to look at three objects, three places, and three books. In each case, we're going to look at an artifact which has loomed large in the imagination of Alan in writing three of his books. We're going to talk about those for a few minutes, and then Robert has very kindly agreed to read passages from each of those books, and Alan will introduce those passages. So we're going to talk for a few minutes about each object and then move on. And because some of the objects are relatively small, we will have them up there on the screen, and I will sort of scroll through those. We'll deal with the first two objects, and then we'll move to the third, and after we finish talking about the third, but before Robert reads the final passage, which is slightly longer, it's probably a good idea if we have a couple of minutes just for people to stretch their legs, because I'm sure I probably already don't need to tell you that those benches are a little unforgiving. I've got a very comfortable seat here, but enjoying that. So perhaps we shall set to, shall we? Okay. So we're going to begin by looking at this thing. And perhaps, Alan, if you would like to start by... How did this come to you?
I'll tell you how it came to me a bit later, but I knew of this thing and things like it all my life. My family live at the foot of Alderley Edge, and these I knew as doorstops. Nobody else asked questions about them. They were just doorstops, and very efficiently are. Then in 1901, the typical gentleman antiquary of the day started to ask questions of these things because he was finding them in specific places on Alderley Edge, which were associated, he felt intuitively, with prehistory. And in his paper of 1901, dozens of these things are illustrated. And how I came to find it was that I was running up the 400-foot scree of Alderley Edge, which consists of the spillage from various periods of mining. And if you grow up on Alderley Edge, you don't have to look where you're going. And I was going up on all fours. It's the only way, it's so steep. And I wasn't looking where I was putting my hand because I knew where I was. I did that. And I froze. I just didn't look because I could feel this polish. And then I did look. And then I covered it over with grass and ran all the way back home and got my camera. And before I lifted it, like a good archaeologist, I photographed it. It's a fascinating photograph. And in my lifetime, I found two of them. And I've also found a stone hammer that makes the groove. So, for me, until I was 18, this was a doorstop.
And probably a very effective doorstop as well. Just say a little bit about how old it is. And it's a hammer, a maul, that dates to the early to middle part of the Bronze Age. So best part of about 4,000 years old. And it's one of thousands that are found both around Alderley and around other natural sources of copper in the British Isles.
And elsewhere.
And indeed elsewhere.
I've handled identical ones in Armenia and in Ohio.
It looks up there and in the hand like a fairly crude and ill-shapen piece of stone, but the fact that you find things like this at mines, and particularly places where there's copper working going on in prehistory, and they all look so similar, broadly very similar, is telling us that actually this is a really good shape to do the work that the thing is made for. You may be thinking, why haven't we turned up here with a really pretty object? A really fine polished blade of jade or something like that. The thing about this is that when you actually start to look at it and look close, it has its own kind of beauty and it has its own kind of story that draws you in. Because it's a fairly simple tool, but it carries on it the marks of its use and the marks of its making very, very clearly. As Alan says, the hand just drops straight onto this groove, which was pecked with other stone hammers to create a recess around which a withy, some kind of strap, would have been bound in order for this to have been used as a sort of large hammer, but also sometimes suspended. I was trying to think of an analogy, like those awful office toys where you knock the balls together. There's no archaeological evidence suggests it did that. But it's been worked very effectively to create this very heavy, very dense, massive tool with an extraordinary amount of pecking and scarring on the end, you can see up there. And these dents in the surface are the dents created by this being pounded against the stone. Now, the interesting thing about this is that these are the things that survive. They're made of stone, so they're very durable. But they are the tip of the iceberg, because associated with this would have been a lot of timber, frames for holding the hammers when they were being used, ladders for getting up the rock face, bonfires that would have been lit to split the stone and crack it and prepare it for ore extraction. And these things are littered around all over the edge, where there is this natural outcrop of copper coming through. And one of the things, again, that as an archaeologist we got very interested in is the idea that rather than just saying there's a copper source and people who wanted to make metal objects went and extracted the copper and smelted it and mixed it to make bronze, that people were coming to a place that had a greater significance than that. That actually for people in the beginning of the Bronze Age, bronze was not just a useful material for making tools. It was something that was that's working was shrouded in magic and prescription, perhaps even taboos. It was a material that could only be found in certain places, places that required journeys. And certainly from the point of view of you growing up near Alderley Edge, I mean, the stories that are attached to the place and to some of the workings as well give us a sense of just how complex those ideas can be.
Very complex. If you're born to a place, and you're actually at a disadvantage because everything's so obvious, you don't ask questions about it. So I came rather late to being intelligent about my own hillside. But my grandfather, who was a smith, he had an intuitive knowledge and feel for the place, and he would talk about things in terms of the late 19th century smith, which I now know he was remembering from a great deal further back in time. And if you want to know more about that, you'll have to turn up at 5 o'clock this evening, when I shall be extremely fascinating on the subject.
Excellent.
One of the other things that I think is quite interesting about objects like this is, again, it holds up a bit of a lens to the way that archaeologists commonly think, rather. And a lot of us, when we find prehistoric or historic objects, we concentrate on the moment when it was made and when it was first used. But actually, an object like this has a life that carries on right the way through to the present, and actually it's the way that things have been picked up on, recognised in different ways and given different meanings that's often just as interesting as what that piece may have meant during the course of the Bronze Age. One of the things that is really interesting, though, is the fact that there are hundreds of these scattered around ore sources, copper sources, like those found on Alderley. And for a long time, it was common for archaeologists to recognise this littering of stones of roughly hewn shape as indicative of them being largely disposable, the sort of polystyrene cups of the day. You'd use them and then you'd toss them to one side.
Well, it's worse than that, Mark, because when eventually these things were taken seriously, it upset a lot of modern living, still working academics who didn't want there to be a Bronze Age on Alderley Edge. Mm. In fact, yeah. Alderley Edge is the oldest dated metalworking site in England as a result of these things. The arguments of what they were by the people who didn't want, for their own reasons, to be a Bronze Age on Alderley Edge were that they were used to hold down the temporary heather coverings of the bothies that the miners worked in. There is no evidence for these structures. But that's what these must be. They're to hold down the roof. And, of course, the argument worked. They would do it. But there's no evidence that there were ever structures for them to be used on. And Mark is in the world where he has to suffer this. People have become fanatical, and they do not want stories. They simply want to know that they are right. And that's very, very sad. But I think if we move on to the next one, Mark, that's the one that really brings everything together very smartly.
I think before Robert does his reading, just the one other thing that I think is nice about these objects is that although they look rough, and we used to imagine that they were disposed, they're found at the source. And one of the things that this tells us is that people left the tools where they were, at the source, at the rock face, where they were working, so that when they left back to their settlements, they anticipated returning. They were going to come back and pick up the tools again and use them again. So again, you can sometimes find there are hints of people's relationships with places that can be found not only in the materials that things are made from, but the way they've been attended to, the way they've been left in certain settings.
And so to move this out of reality into fiction, when I came to write The Weird Cerebral Singleman, I was aware of the power of these things in my imagination. They really did get to me. And so I used them. And in The Weird Cerebral Singleman, there are some very unpleasant creatures that live underground. They are the Svart Alfar. and they have weapons. And Robert, if you will now go and read, we shall see how I use that.
A bit of the weird stone. Ahead of them, a light flickered red on the tunnel wall.
What would you do now, cousin? Said Durathror. Do we run like shadows, or do we snuff it out? We are too near, said Fenodiri. We must not turn back. Good. Then we shall do this. Let the men children stand here. You go forward to that opening and stay hidden, with Widowmaker drawn till I call. I shall wait behind this boulder. Hold your ground, Stone Maiden. Be not afraid. No Svart shall touch you. That I can promise. The light grew stronger and cast shadows on the wall, spindly shadows with broad heads and hands, and round the bend in the tunnel came the Svarts. There were 10 of them. Each carried a pine torch that had been dipped in the flames of the Firedrake's blood. From a girdle round each of their waists hung a crude axe or hammer. The head was a roughly worked stone, kidney or dumbbell-shaped. There was a groove about the middle, round which was bent a withy, lashed tight with thongs. The lamp trembled in Colin's hand. The Svarts halted and sighed, and slowly they began to advance. Colin flashed the lamp into their eyes, but they did not do more than blink and laugh. The children retreated. The Svarts rushed, and Durathror stepped from behind the boulder, his sword Durnwin in his hand. He bowed low before them and spoke in their own tongue. Greetings, we are well met. The Svarts fell back, hissing like lizards, and those to the rear had more courage. See, it is he whom we must kill. The men children are of no matter, but our lords have long wanted his life. So there is courage in Svart Alfarheim, said Durathror. This is a day of marvels. Let my sword test the metal of your new-found backbones. We come! We come! Gondomar, cried Durathror, and he whirled Durnwin above his head with both hands. 2 Svarts died under that stroke. They buckled at the knees and crumbled into dust. Gondomar! The sparks flew from iron on stone, but there were now 6 Svarts in the tunnel and 4 torches guttering on the sand. The Svarts ran. Durathror rested on his sword. Cousin, it would seem that Durnwin is too bitter for their taste. Let them savor Widowmaker. Fenodiri came from hiding. He laid about him in silence. He did not share Durathror's joy. And the uproar grew less. Fenodiri's helmet spun underfoot and his mail shirt rang, but not for long. The dwarfs stood gazing at each other across a litter of torches and stone hammers. Widowmaker is well named, said Durathror. She has gained 2 upon me in this fight. I must find me more Svarts. Come away, cousin, said Fenodiri. We must not turn from the path nor rest till we are beyond their reach. Colin picked up a hammer. It was heavy but balanced well. Shall we take some? They could be useful. They would drag you to your death where we are going, said Fenodiri. Leave them. We do not need such tainted things.
Okay. Right, we'll move on to the second object, an object that when Alan, with all due ceremony, dropped it into my hand, created quite a spark. It's an extraordinary and rather small thing, hence the pictures up here. And again, perhaps, Alan, if you want to just start us off.
This is perhaps one of the most exciting and important archaeological objects. It resonates forever. And it came into my hands in 1950. And 1.5 miles from Alderley Edge is the raised peat moss of Lindo, which is used for the extraction of peat to provide you with grow bags. And in 1950, a peat digger who, and this is the important part, was digging by hand, not by machine, at a depth of about 4 to 6 feet in his trench, in the peat, found this. He recognized that it was important, and he took it to the Museum of Manchester, who, without any recognition of his extraordinary sense of duty, or without his permission, filed pieces off the dark bit, and the report says it's a piece of hematite with quark crystals on it. And because they'd done it without his permission, this untutored peat digger took it back and said to his drinking mate, the postman, "Give it to our Alan. He'll look after it better." Which I did, because it's an extraordinary object. That was 1950. And because it was dug by hand, we know at the approximate depth in the peat where it was found. And to make it short, it was found at the same depth and within 100 meters of Lindow Man, who was discovered in 1984. The first really significant, by that I mean studied, bog body in Britain. So, a piece of hematite, Manchester University got that bit right, and quartz, and they totally missed the question, how on earth did it get 4 to 6 feet down in a peat bog in Cheshire?
You expect me to answer that?
Yep.
It's an extraordinary object because, again, with my archaeological hat on, an object like this, and the details of which you can see up there, really challenges really basic taken-for-granteds. I work in a discipline that was formed out of antiquarian interests in the later 18th and certainly, particularly the 19th century, and it's a discipline that formed alongside others, like geology. And that means that quite often when we're working as archaeologists, we say, well, these objects belong with us because we're archaeologists, those objects belong with geologists. So artifacts that have been fashioned by people in the past, they're for us. Objects like this belong in the world of geology and geological discussion. The very fact of the placement of this object in the peat at the same depth as the bog body that's become known as Lindow Man tells us that this was also an object of thought in the past, that people perceived it, they thought about it, they gave it some form of significance. And that kind of significance, whatever it was, completely cuts across the boundaries between our disciplines. We see history on the one side and geology on the other. People in the past may have understood the world around them in very, very different ways. And actually, if you start to ask yourself, you realize that we do that too. Just have a glance at an Ordnance Survey map and just see how many named places there are out in what appears to be the middle of nowhere. So we have a very complicated relationship with nature, and that's what this piece really does to me, is to bring out some of those ideas, some of those qualities. Now, there are parallels for this. Not in the sense of other pieces of quartz and hematite laid to rest with bodies in bogs, bodies that appear to have been placed there as forms of sacrifice. Sometimes the person has been killed and then placed into the bog, and that seems to have been something that was done with due ceremony. So objects are being placed in or near with the body or near the body, perhaps as part of that same process. But there are other sites where we find quartz used in other kinds of arrangements. For example, there's a number of tombs, Neolithic and Bronze Age tombs, where the entire surface of the floor of the tomb is coated in quartz. There are other places where you find quartz has been rammed into the interstices of the stone walling that defines a tomb. And there are stone circles, particularly in Scotland, where quartz, again, is laid out as a carpet around the circle, which would create a very dramatic visual effect, but also, what's it called?
Piezoelectricity.
Thank you. Piezoelectricity. The rubbing of quartz, the crushing and the crunching of quartz, particularly at night, can create a light like pale moonlight. And so again, there may well be all sorts of qualities to the way in which this material reacts with people, which may have been important to folk at the time.
If you dance on a floor of this stuff underground, it can light up.
Your feet catch fire.
Yeah. Just think what that could mean if you had no knowledge of science. And it's not only Europe, it's worldwide. And I'm going to throw Mark back in. I'm going to hold on to this for a moment. It's always seems to have a very strong connection with life, life and death, birth, rebirth. And in Australia, it is the ultimate spiritual object. It is the semen of the dream time, the ancestors' semen left behind. So I came to write a book based on fact. I don't make things up. I find things. And 5 miles from Alderley Edge, there was a man called William Buckley, who in 1802 was transported for life to Australia. And the convicts had a very strange to us now perception of space-time, but it was quite ordinary to them. They believed that when they got to Australia, if they walked north to China and turned left, they would come to the Elephant and Castle. But of course they needed a map, so they would take a piece of shirt tail, a scrap of anything, and on it they would draw a cross with a top to it and pointing north. And they would hold the thing like that and follow it. As a result of which, very few of them were ever seen again. William Buckley decided that he was going to walk home. And after the first few minutes, this is regular practice, of being shot at, the guard decided to save their ammunition. And William Buckley disappeared. And to cut the story short, it wasn't short for him, he must have walked for 2 years alone in that dreadful outback, not knowing where he was. And at the end of his life, he was crawling, and he saw a stick in a mound just ahead of him, and he thought that would help him get to China. He crawled, reached up, and died. The effort killed him. He was found by a group of Aborigines who had no concept of Europeans, but they did believe that the dead became white. And the stick was not the stick, it was a spear, and the mound was not a mound, it was a burial mound of their great Arthurian figure, except that he'd been dead a few years only, Murrumburg. And they thought Murrumburg could come back. And for 32 years, William Buckley lived as an Aborigine. Now, for the writer in me and the anthropologist, that's a lovely story, but it doesn't make sense. If you have come back from the dead, okay, we'll accept that you are 6 feet 5 7/8 inches tall, which he was. We accept you're white, and it's quite acceptable that you don't understand a word of what we're saying. But at the end of the 32 years, William saved the next whites to appear from being massacred. Now, The anthropologist in me knows that for him to have the authority to do that, he was an elder, a leader, and a shaman. And to come from being a laborer in Marton, Cheshire, was a considerable journey. Now, Robert is going to read two short passages. One from before the time that William Buckley goes to Australia. He is sitting on the edge of a mere because the love of his life, and he had seen a rainbow strike the water. Now, rainbows, again, are very important. These things produce rainbows. And his love, Esther, wants to go to the end of the rainbow. So they walk along a fallen alder log, and the rainbow, of course, isn't there, and they sit there. And the first section is what happens next. So if Robert will read the first section, I'll then link you to the next.
To the second section.
Yeah. So you stay up there.
Yeah, I will. I will come back.
Oh, before you start, Robert, there's that word. There is a Cheshire word which is used as a love token, and it's called swaddledydaff, a love token.
Right, this is the first excerpt from Strandloper. He caught hold of her wrist and wrote with her hand in the water, "I do love thee." She pulled her hand clear. The water shimmered and was still. "I do love thee," he said. "And I do love thee," she said. "But you'll get that slutch off first." He tried to kiss her. "No, not while you get that slutch off. I do love you, Het." She laughed and splashed water at him. She reached down to scoop more, but her fingers caught on a hardness in the mud. She took it and put it into his hand. "There, don't say I never give you nothing." It was a stone, a black stone, flecked with red, part bubbled as a brain, part rough as frost, and all stuck about with clear crystals that winked in the light. He held it on his palm. "It's a swaddledydaff," she said. "From the end of the rainbow," said William. "Our swaddledydaff," she said. "From me to thee." The rainbow was gone.
So when William is sent to Australia, he takes one thing with him. He keeps a swaddledydaff. And of course, when it goes into an Aboriginal context, it changes its function completely and is a sign of great authority. It is the semen of the dreaming. And he has it in his hand when he is found by the Aborigines. All the more reason to be certain that this is Murrumbeek, come back. And he is given a little bag to keep it in while he's recovering. And the next section is a dream, or is it a dream? It's the beginning of his reabsorption into the culture of the Aboriginal mind, and it is his first re-initiation.
They were asleep now, he knew, but he was dreaming. He was dreaming the fires and the sleepers, all as they were. The man with feathers in his hair, who had given him the woven bag for the swaddledydaff, came towards him. He was painted with red clay, and he looked down into his eyes, then turned and walked. William followed him. They walked among the trees beyond the firelight, under the moon, and came to a lake. Near it was a rock. In front of the rock sat the old men in a circle, and all were painted with the red clay. They sang and clapped the ringing sticks together. The man led him into the circle and painted him as the men, and then stood him before the rock. He forced his right hand open against the stone and sprayed red clay over it with his mouth. The print of the hand was sharp on the stone. The man wound a net about his head so that he could not see and held him by the arms from behind. The old men stopped their singing, but still beat the sticks. Slowly, and the echo of them bounced off the rock and grew louder until the rock itself was ringing, and he could no longer hear the sticks behind him, but only the clashing of the rock before. He felt the hands on his shoulders tighten, and they moved him into balance, holding him, and then at a pause between the echo, he was shoved forward and would have fallen but for the hands, and the echo was behind him, then silent everywhere. The hands unwound the net. He was inside the rock, and the old men were sitting in a circle, and the walls and the roof were all of shining crystals. He turned around. There was no way out of the cave. He was in a skep of brightness and humming light. Each crystal fitted the next, though they were of different size and shape, but he saw that they had five sides. Even the smallest made a clunch of five. But the wall was not right. There was a hole. He went to it and touched it, yet though he could see the hole, he could not put his fingers in. The air would not yield. He looked at the man. The man looked at him. He looked again at the hole. He knew the shape. It was not five sides, but an egg, rough and black. There was no moon outside, but the black was full of stars. And it was not one sky, but many, bubbled as a brain. And every sky had stars, and the stars were of the humming. He took the Swaddledidaf from the bag at his shoulder and placed it against the hole. The shape fitted, and the air held it. The Swaddledidaf left no gap. The wall was made.
The reading tells us that the meanings of things are not grafted onto objects after the fact. They are the fact. And that when we want to try and understand why things are treated the way they are, why they're deposited in the way that they are, why they're picked up again over time, it's because we need to think directly about the perception of those things, the way they were given meaning by people in prehistory and right the way through to the present. First time I read that, I read that passage, it just bowled me over because I was working on the study of a stone source in Cumbria at the time, and it just chimed so strongly, so much so that it's now on my reading list at university. Let's move on to the third object now, and again up here on the screen, a little dimly lit, a small stone book. Alan, perhaps a few.
Anybody who gets involved with our family changes. We were looking for extending our medieval hovel so that it had a septic tank and an extra room, as a result of which we ended up dismantling a 10-room Tudor apothecary's house 18 miles away and re-erecting it. And one of the men who was working on that, he started off as an unemployed, lowest level, cheapest we can get off the dole queue at the labour exchange at Crewe, please. He and his brother-in-law were employed as muscle, and they ended up being skilled craftsmen. They knew how that house came down because they took it down. It was like it was a Tudor Lego. And they put it back up again. And in doing so, they found the things in the house. That is another subject we could spend a whole day on. The things that have been placed into the house at various periods from its building in around 1500 to protect the house. So Cedric Wheeler, the great Ced, took to spending his weekends looking at old derelict buildings. And he appeared one Monday morning with this, which he'd found in an old crumbling shed in an old crumbling farmyard. And as you can see, it works as a book. It is actually credible up to within about a foot. It will have had a brass cross set into it. That has gone. It's also been damaged. There are grooves that have been cut, and they would have either been behind the cross if they predate the cross, or they are a part of the removal of the cross and what was done to the stone. Now, if you're going to take a stone book and take the cross off, perhaps you're going to recycle it, I don't know. But why attack the book? And what is the point of having a book that you can't read?
Well, I've written a few of those. I've seen things of this nature before, and they crop up at various times in the historic past, and they're interpreted in lots of different ways. This one, made of slate, is very similar in its general character to a number of pieces that I've seen working on quarries in the northern part of Wales, around Penrhyn and Llanberis. And one possible suggestion as to how these things come into being and why they come into being is that they're apprentice pieces. That people learning to work slate are given an opportunity to, not just slate for roofing, where they're riving and splitting sheets of slate, but when they're actually making more decorative slate for houses, and particularly in the Victorian period, that they would be expected to make something to demonstrate that they had skills in working against the grain of the slate. And so something like this might be the sort of apprentice piece that would be created. But that actually isn't usually what happens. Apprentice pieces tend to be rather more flamboyant than that. And what we often find in North Wales, and indeed in other parts of the country, is that people make these for themselves. And they make them for themselves for other reasons. And there are several different reasons, but several of them within that take the point of departure from Alan's point about what's the point of a book you can't read. One suggestion that's been made by historians is that books like this matter because they are owned by and carried into church by people who can't read. That they are a symbol of the book which they carry, or a psalter or a hymnal. It doesn't matter that you can't open it in the conventional sense, because what it signifies is your adherence to the word, even if the word in its printed form escapes you. That's certainly one possibility. Another possibility is that they're carved as memorials, a book that cannot be opened, certainly in terms of the sort of iconography, the symbolism of memorials in the Victorian era. It's very common to find books in stone where that's the kind of imagery that's being evoked, a book that can't be opened, a book that can't be read, a life that's been drawn to a close. So these things, in their character, might say something about adherence to a particular set of values, a particular set of beliefs. They might also hold, in the pages that you can't read, the memory of particular people. And of course, they stay in the house and in the family, handed on and handed down, perhaps, through the generations. Which brings us back to the point that Alan made at the beginning of his description about why these things are found in houses. Can you say a little bit more about it?
It's a big subject, but I shall not make it big. The magic. I like to think of it as it's the science that we've not yet discovered. And if you think of all the things that can go wrong when you have no sense of science whatsoever, your cow drops dead for no apparent reason. And the only connection you can think of is that old Biddy Garner looked at you strangely yesterday. Burner. It happened. I mean, this is behind a great deal of the horror of the witch trials. And so we find, and I mean we, because of the work we did on dismantling the house and adding it to an earlier house, a medieval house, we have found in the fabrics of both buildings what are called apotropaic objects, and even markings, little scratches in the wood. And these objects are placed at the weak points of a house, usually in the context of a doorway, a window, a chimney, if there is one. And very commonly, and we have them, worn shoes. They are at the chimney. Why? Is it a kind of distraction for the witch or the malevolence? We don't know. Are these, because these also have been found in the context of a building, and they haven't been lost, they have been placed. They've actually been placed behind wood, solid timber. So they're powerful in themselves. And before we end this session, because Robert is going to give you the whole works on this, I'd still like to have Mark's thoughts, because I don't have any, and I promise you we have not set this up beforehand. This is coming cold. Why would anybody set out to damage the book?
The scratches that you can see on the surface, that you can't see, that you can now see on the surface, are really deep. I've put my thumbnail backwards and forwards in them several times when we've had this conversation about why these deep gouges should be there. Were they there before the cross? Were they there as a function of taking the cross off? Were they there after? On balance, I'd say probably that they've been gouged into it after the cross has come off. I don't know. Nothing wrong with admitting I don't know. Doesn't mean to say I can't make up a story. But if this is an object that matters to people, if this is an object that is important to somebody, that importance might be marked by treating it with reverence, treating it with respect, placing it somewhere where it could serve a useful purpose in protecting the household. But things change. People die bad deaths, people fall out of favour, and objects that are somehow connected to them have some kind of biographical link. Sometimes they need to be dealt with. Sometimes you need to scratch away the familiar surface and take the negative connotations out of an object before it can be used, treated, or handled in different ways. When we talk about Australia and Aboriginal understandings of the world in stone, our imaginations are perhaps more inclined to accept that that might well be the case, that people thought about and think about things in that way. It's exactly the same for us, and it certainly is a very important theme in understanding people's relationships to stone in the 18th, 19th, and even 20th century. People were still putting stone axes in water troughs in the 1850s and 1860s because a stone axe from the Neolithic in a water trough would protect your cattle from being ill. And if you scratched the surface of one and put the dust in some milk and gave it to your children, they'd sleep well. We're always making stories about these things. And we're working and reworking those stories, editing, if you like, as we go along. But in answer to his question, I don't know why.
And I think that's the importance. Why should we? We come into this world and are educated in places, and we're always expected to come up with an answer. Perhaps the answer is something that is beyond our comprehension or beyond our retrieval.